My name is Amy Fennell. I am the supervisor of training for Natural Encounters.
Hello, I'm John Rossi. I'm a touring drummer with a passion for animal conservation. When I'm on the road, I spend as much time as possible visiting zoos, aquariums, and conservation organizations. Now, I want to share those places with you. I'll be talking to keepers, vets, conservationists, anyone who can help me in my mission of connecting my people to animals through their people. Join me on my raw safari. Hello, 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 and welcome back to the Raw Safari Podcast. All right, y'all. So, earlier this season, I released my interview with Steve Martin of Natural Encounters, Inc. And that episode got such a huge reaction. I got so many comments, so many compliments. People just loved Steve, loved our discussion, and really loved everything that was said about the work that NEI does. And so when I found out that a team from NEI was going to be doing the bird show at Roger Williams Park Zoo in Providence, Rhode Island this past summer, I knew that I had to get up there and interview someone from that team. So, of course, when I made a trek up to Providence, I swung through Massachusetts and caught up with our good friend, Danny Poirier-Larson, who, as you know, is the head of the bird training program and honestly so much more stuff at Southwick's Zoo in Mendon, Massachusetts. Now, Danny had made some connections with some people and knew that she would be able to connect us to the NEI team. And we just kind of went out and checked out the shows that they were doing, two different shows at Roger Williams Park Zoo, and started talking to the team. And right from the start, I knew that I was meeting some incredible people, including Amy Fennell, who you're going to hear from today. My first interaction with Amy actually was one of the funnier moments that I've had while doing this podcast, even though I wasn't up there for the pod at this particular time. So we went to one of the bird shows that they were doing at the zoo. And then afterwards, Danny was like, okay, that's Amy, and we have a mutual friend, and I'm supposed to connect with her. So we walked up, and Danny was all like, hi, I'm Danny, blah, 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 talking about myself. Everybody loves me because everybody loves Danny. And then she said, oh, and by the way, this is my friend, John. And before she could say my last name, before she could explain what Raw Safari is, any of that stuff, Amy looked at me and went, oh my God, it's the Red Panda drummer guy. And y'all, that's me. That's who I am. I'm the Red Panda drummer guy. I was so happy and I loved so much that she knew who I was. And it turned out that after Steve did his interview for the podcast, he told his whole staff about how much he enjoyed it. And they all did a little digging into who I was. And most of them started listening to the pod and everything. So like, yay, Raw Safari with NEI. I love that there's that connection. And I love that Amy just knew who I was. So our first day there, we got to go behind the scenes. We got to see what they do to get ready for their bird show. We got to watch the bird show from out front and just see how cool it was. I got called up and got to have a bird fly right over my head. It was really exciting. And then at the end of the day, there was a fly-off that you're going to hear a lot more about in this episode. It was quite entertaining. And as a matter of fact, if you listen to Zoo News, you'll know the fly-off I'm talking about because it made news. And we talked about it on a previous Zoo News episode. But anyway, the evening ended with Amy agreeing to be on the podcast. And so the entire summer went by and I was off gigging and she and her team were doing shows. But right before they left Roger Williams, I went back up to Providence, grabbed Danny on the way up. Zoe came with me. And we sat down and did our interview with Amy Fennell. And in the process, we got to see what happens during bird shows. We got to watch from behind the scenes during one of the shows. We also got to watch from out front, but with the radios that the team uses right there with us. So we could hear the calls being made. We could hear the communication. We really got to go in depth into what it takes to make an incredible bird show with a lot of free-flying birds in it happen. And it was so much fun. I'm so thankful to Amy and the entire team that was there because they were all absolutely incredible and so just open and fun and silly but professional and most importantly just super welcoming. It was awesome. I loved the entire team so much. We all felt so very welcome. And yeah, so now you're going to get to hear about all of that and what goes into it, and you'll get to hear some questions from Danny and a quiz that it's just a one question quiz that Zoe, Danny, and I all took that only one of us got the right answer. Yeah, so a lot of fun stuff. But hey, before we get to that, I want to drop a quick reminder to make sure that you hit subscribe so you don't miss any episodes. Leave ratings and reviews wherever you listen, please. They really make a huge difference to the podcast. Don't forget to follow along on all the social medias at Raw Safari and on TikTok at Raw Safari Pod. Oh, and one final note about this interview. We did it at the place where all the birds live. So it's not just me and Amy and Danny and Zoe that you're going to hear, but a whole lot of birds in the background, too, which I think just adds a really nice ambiance to the interview. And so without further ado, here is my interview with Amy Fennell featuring Danny Poirier Larson and a brief Zoe cameo.
I am very lucky to be part of the team that's working at Roger Williams Park Zoo here in Rhode Island on a summer show that we are calling Dinosaurs in Flight. We're almost wrapping it up, but we've had a really great summer. We've got some amazing birds here and some amazing people here, and I'm happy to be here.
Awesome. Thank you. So, this is going to be the spiritual follow-up, we'll call it, to my interview that was earlier in the season with Steve Martin, who you work for.
What? Who's Steve?
I know,
that's
right?
That's crazy. No, yes, he's amazing. I'm so fortunate to be able to work with him and for him and at NEI. I hope you enjoyed the experience you had with him.
Not only did I enjoy the experience, but that was my most commented on episode ever. I heard from so many people who were so blown away by it. It was one of the reasons that I wanted to hunt you down here before we ended things.
All right. So. Well, that's they're big shoes to fill because I can't possibly fill them. Steve's amazing. As I said, we're very lucky to work for him and with him. It's amazing to be able to come out and do a show like this for a zoo like this. People seem happy so far. It's crazy that we're almost done this experience because we started April 14th. And now it is, what, August 29th? I don't know when this will air, but, you know.
Neither do I.
Yeah.
At some point in life.
But it is, it has been a while. And it's really cool because one of the things that roadshows are great for is staff development and bird development and seeing people succeed over time and learn and grow and do new things. So it's been great.
Very cool. And along with the two of us chilling here is somebody else who's going to introduce herself now.
Hi, it's me. I'm Danny Poirier Larson. I've been on the episode or on the podcast a few times, and it's such an honor to be here with John and Amy. So I'm really excited.
Yeah. And part of why I wanted Danny here is, of course, because she is a bird nerd and a great trainer, and she can ask the questions that I can't because drummer. But also because this is actually our second time now visiting Roger Williams together, specifically to come check out the NEI Bird Show here. And we got to come towards the beginning of the season, and now we're back at the end of the season. So we too have seen some growth. So I'm excited to dig into all of this. But let's start off. Amy, like, how did you get to this world?
Oof, that's a question. I think everybody comes to this field from a very different angle. My path was weird, as many people's paths are. I have always loved animals. My first job was working at a vet clinic when I was 16 years old, work study with high school. But I was fortunate to be with parents who, like, when we drove to my grandma's house, we were always counting red-tailed hawks at the side of the road. So always loved birds, always loved animals. And when I was in university, I loved parrots, and we had a parrot club. And the parrot club one day said, hey, don't bring your parrots next month because we're going to have raptors there. And I went, okay. And then I showed up, and I was a university student, and they said they brought birds of prey, non-releasable birds of prey. There's a red tail and a great horned owl and amazing animals. And they said, yeah, we take undergrad volunteers. And I was like, what? So I started with that program in 2003. And it developed from there. In a few years, I was a supervisor with that program. And then I got a start at a nearby raptor center that I ended up being fortunate enough to be the lead of. So I was running a raptor center in Canada for a while. And I loved birds and I loved flying. And the best place to do that was at NEI. And when I would never have left my old place except for the job of my dreams, and it became an option, and I moved from Canada to Florida.
So it's quite the move.
Yes, it was, especially at 30 years old. Like, that's that's a huge move. I gave up a pension. I gave up a lot of stuff, and I have never once regretted it. It has been the most formative and amazing move of my life to join NEI, and I'm so grateful for it, because I would never have learned any of what I know now with these animals if I hadn't made that leap of faith.
That's awesome. I really love and respect that. So, you know, I'm curious. You talk about how meaningful it is to be part of the NEI team. How did you find the confidence then to go into that situation and, like, trust your skills and say, like, you know, yeah, this is the place and I deserve to be there?
Ooh, I had no idea I deserved to be there at all. No, okay. There was zero confidence. But it was worth the risk. And I will never forget that interview, because it was at a conference, IAATE conference, which is the International Association of Avian Trainers and Educators, in 2014 in Dallas, when I was so excited because I was coming from Canada to Texas in February, and it was going to be so warm, and it was snowing. And I hated that. But I also was able to interview for this position, and it was a lunchtime interview, and it was Ari Bailey, Steve Martin, and Cassie Molina, who's gone on to do additional amazing things. Obviously, Steve and Ari are still with us. And it was, I don't think I ate anything at that lunch interview. It was so stressful. I've told Steve this story once, but I don't know if he remembers it. It was February, and it was unbelievable weather in Dallas. So I was supposed to fly home from Dallas. I did that interview. We finished the conference, and I went home to Canada. And it should have been a 5-hour flight, like, to get home. And instead it was 30 hours of canceled flights. Oof. And I think I ended up flying from Dallas to O'Hare to LaGuardia. No, not LaGuardia. No, I like we just zigzagged. And it was crazy. And I finally got home. And of course, they lost my luggage. So I think I limped into my house at 6 a.m. when I should have been home the previous day. And I, like, went face first on the floor. And I think I napped for a bit. And then my phone rang. And it was like Steve Martin. And I go, and he goes, hi, you know, you know, we really enjoyed interviewing you. I'd like to offer you the position. I'm like, okay. And you could tell from his response, he's like, well, I thought you'd be more excited. And I'm like, I don't know what day it is right now. Like, I don't, I mean, yeah, I am excited. I'm trying, what? And he was like, oh, okay, well, you know, we'll talk soon. And I was like, okay. And I hung up the phone and I just like face planted on the floor and was like, oh no, what have I done? But it was great. It was the start of the rest of my life, which right. has been amazing.
That's awesome. And so this is a road show mm-hmm. because, as you mentioned, y'all are based in Florida.
Yes.
And Roger Williams Park Zoo is not based in Florida, and the commute would be a lot. So talk about what goes into figuring out, like, how do you come to a zoo? And once the contract is signed, how do you get everyone and everything here? Because I know a lot of the stuff, even in this building, y'all made happen.
Yes, so, we did.
So talk about that.
Yeah, so there's a lot that goes into setting up road shows. There's a lot of operational stuff. There is housing for staff. There is transporting the birds. There is the health certificates that are needed, like the legal stuff for transporting these animals across borders. There is the physical stuff of getting all of the caging and everything else physically on site. And I think the cool thing is that we've done this for so many places and for so many years that it's kind of a well-oiled machine at this point. We know what's needed. In this case, it took two Penske trucks, two 26-foot Penske trucks, to load all of the caging and set everything up here. So the setup crew comes in advance. They come and they know which birds are coming. They set up all the caging. They do all the perching. They make it so that when the birds arrive, the birds come out of their crates and go into their homes, and it's comfortable for them. And then there's the bird crew, which I am usually on, and we pack up all the birds in a beautiful bird trailer, and it's all air conditioned and awesome, and we drive a long way, and then we get here and we unload them into their new summer homes.
Nice. That's very cool. Why can't they just fly up?
Oh, well,
I thought they were free flight birds. I mean,
you were here for the last time the military's tried that. They could probably fly home. They tried. They flew to the airport the other day.
So, let's talk about this more, though. So, all right. So y'all figure out what birds are going to be in the show.
Yeah.
And is that something that y'all just decide, or is that something that you work with the zoo on?
It's 50-50. So the zoo might have species requirements or just preferences, mm-hmm. like something that they're interested in. But one of the things that I do in my role is if you tell me what the show is and what the goal is, I will provide the list of potential birds for that show, based on our collection, based on our needs, based on the trainers involved, based on the birds. I do my best in that situation to be able to provide good information about who might be most successful. And then other people will chime in and we'll collectively make a decision on who goes. But in case of this show, the cool thing is, we have two big shows. We call them the stage shows. And then we have two, like, they're really cute. We call them the farmyards shows. And they're often for like little kids, like really little kids. And so that's our kind of tiny show. And so the birds who are there do kind of a different type of behavior than the birds who are at the main show. They're a little bit more flexible. They're totally fine to run around a bunch of 3-year-old kids. They don't care if a 3-year-old kid tries to grab them. It's a good setup. And there are some birds that wouldn't be able to do that or that wouldn't be the right fit for it. And there are some birds that wouldn't be the right fit for the stage show. So you just have to know your collection, know the goal, and then try to make sure that you've paired the best birds with that behavior.
Makes sense. And then do you know roughly what you're getting into as far as the physical space? Because like the building that we are in right now is not an aviary.
It is not. We call it the Bongo Barn. Well, they call it the Bongo Barn. And it has been used as a multi-species housing space. I think before we got here, there were marmosets and tortoises in here. You know, I came out here in January, well before we were going to come here with our management staff, and took a look at it and started the planning for how many enclosures can we fit in here safely, who could go in which of these enclosures. We take pictures, we map it out, and we measure, you know, where can we fit these enclosures, and making sure that the birds have, you know, what they need to be comfortable. So, you know, we come in advance. And then when we come for real, we have all the information we need to set everything up.
Have you ever had an experience, or do you have a plan in place if you haven't, for like when you get to the place to initially look at it and, you know, it's three matchsticks hanging over and they're like, here's your roof, you're good, and that's all you get?
If that happened, I would say that we didn't do our research well enough. I've never experienced it, because I think one of the things that NEI does extremely well, and the zoos that we communicate with do very well, is we tell them what is needed and they say, here's your spot, and we have the time to look at it. And I've never had a situation where we've shown up and what we were given wasn't the thing that we experienced.
Sure. I was asking more, or what I meant to ask more, I didn't phrase it really well, was like if that first time that you showed up, like if you showed up here, you know, for the very first time and you were going to get your measurements, and it, like I said, it was like, you know, a little shack or something. Not that Roger Williams Part 2 would ever do that, but, you know, hypothetically at another place, what is the, do you guys have a plan in place for that? Or
we would just tailor what we were able to offer to what they were able to give us.
Cool.
So if we came and there was only the appropriate housing for like three birds, then that's what we could offer them. And if they said no, then we would be like, we want to be good partners here, but here are the limitations for us. We need to provide these animals with this space. You know, the welfare of our birds comes before anything else. So if you can do this, great. And if you can't, then well, we'll talk later. But yeah, I've never experienced that.
That's really cool. I love that. And I'm kind of curious. So you're here as NEI, but you never say NEI in the shows or anything. And you are wearing a Roger Williams Park Zoo shirt right now.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, I double checked with PR here just to make sure. Like, Corey's great. I knew it wouldn't be a problem. But I did do a check-in, even though I'm not interviewing anyone from the zoo, but I am. And I don't know. So I'm just curious, like, I guess, you know, do you feel a sense of being a person at whatever zoo you're at? Do you feel like you're part of the team here? And also, how does NEI promote itself if you're not out there saying who you are?
Yeah, I mean, those are all good questions. The first part of that is, yes, absolutely. We feel a part of the Roger Williams Park Zoo team. They have been nothing but incredibly generous to us, both with their time, their animals, their space. This is, I mean, I've been on a bunch of road shows, and this is one of the most warm and accommodating teams that I've ever experienced.
Wow.
Like these people are good people. They're great. And I'm going to be sad to go home, because they're wonderful. Not a single person here hasn't been willing to share their expertise and their passion for their animals or their area of expertise. So it's been great. The second part of that is, I don't feel like promoting NEI is a thing for us.
Okay.
I think we know what we do and we feel really proud of what we do. And I hope other people know what we do. We have as much work as we need to have. There's never been a time I remember when we're hurting for people looking for our expertise. If that happens in the future, maybe we'll talk about how we can promote ourselves. But at this point, I think word of mouth and the fact that I hope that our work speaks for itself is good enough.
Yeah, that's great. Awesome. And I'm curious, so since y'all are experts, is the staff able to take advantage of your expertise while you're here? Does it go kind of both ways?
Whenever it's asked for. So like we'll never offer try to put ourselves on anybody else. But like I've had a really, really great experience this summer at Rainforest in at Roger Williams Park Zoo with the boat-billed herons and the ibis with one of the lead keepers there, and just working through how to get those birds to be comfortable coming down around the public has been, I hope, as enriching for the staff as it has been for me, because I was able to get a picture of one of those birds down on a platform that I don't think either of us thought would be possible at the very beginning. So yes, but like by their choice.
Right.
So
right.
We're available at all times. I mean, all we want to do is do bird, well, any behavior, animal behavior, and help where we can. And if people ask, we are happy to provide.
That's awesome. Yeah, I know. While we were here today, there was a question about a bird that came in through your phone that was pretty entertaining. yeah, keepers have some interesting stuff on their phones, don't they?
You missed the last part of that.
Oh, no.
You saw some of it. I think that the keeper, and saying this in very positive terms, was, do you think this bird is feeling feelings that might be mating related? And then sent me a video, and it was fairly explicit.
It was bird porn. Let's call it,
it was a cloaca, and it was a very large cloaca, and it was right there. And I'm like, yes, I think that's fair to say that that bird is feeling that way. And it's great, like, you know, because first of all, it made me laugh, and I hope it made the keeper laugh too, because she's amazing. Yep. Sometimes you just need a second opinion to go, yep, that is a thing. That is a cloaca.
Yes, I love that. That's very cool. So when it comes to the training stuff here, as far as when the birds come here, how like pre-trained are they, if that's a proper term? And how much work are you doing here?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we typically will, first of all, know what sorts of behaviors we're going to ask these animals to do. Generally, not always, but generally, those birds will have a level of behavioral fluency before we come, and that the goal once we arrive is just to generalize them to the environment. So the behavior is already there, and all that we need is for them to be comfortable with where they are. In this particular case, this is one of the shows where I think we arrived on April 4th and we opened shows on April 14th.
Wow.
So that was one of the, usually we have 3 to 4 weeks of pre-training. And in this case, we had like 10 days and it was fine. It was good. But the thing that makes that possible is knowing and picking the individuals and making sure that the behavior is solid before you travel.
Makes sense. And I want to have Danny and you discuss the behavior stuff more, but I have one more question about this first, which is obviously I have to bring this up, but the first time that Danny and I were here, some of the military macaws decided to go and explore Providence. And it became such a thing. I actually had to talk about it on Zoo News because like the zoo had to put out social media posts about it and everything. So will you talk about that? And also just talk about like, what is a fly off like for you?
I actually wrote a paper on it about what fly-offs are like. It's available on our website. Fly-offs...
She says she doesn't promote them.
Hey-o! Fly-offs are what the person says they are. For one person, a fly-off might be that bird who's done the same A to B for 13 years going up in a tree that they've never been in. For some people, a fly-off might be 3 military macaws piecing out from the zoo and going 9 miles away to the airport.
Yeah.
So fly-offs are part of flying birds. If we're going to free fly birds, we have to understand that fly-offs are going to happen. Our organizational awareness and our preparedness is what's going to make those fly-offs as non-catastrophic as they can possibly be. So there have been some bad fly-offs. There's been some many more very easily resolved fly-offs. And part of the paper that I wrote on this was doing it by the numbers. So for example, for another show, we had 19 fly-offs in the training, the pre-training, out of 140,000 flights.
Wow. Okay.
So if you look at, I mean, even you guys here today have seen how many individual birds do multiple free flights, and everybody's safe and secure. So fly-offs are a part of life, and we have to be prepared for them. But they're also, if the training is there, a relatively insignificant percentage of those flights. And not to say that we take them lightly, but to say that we give them their due and that we want to make sure that if there is a fly-off, that we have all of the information and all of the tools and all of the training to be able to resolve it successfully and quickly. Those militaries, that was a thing. And those birds, as individuals, were birds who have flown in Florida, have flown in other areas. And in this case, when they flew in the same like length that they've flown in the past, which would have gotten them to forest at home, they were in the middle of a city here. So that was new for them. We were able, thanks to wonderful, wonderful people in the community, to give us the information and say, here's the bird. And we went, cool. And we showed up, and then they got TikTok famous. So, you know, that was the thing that was new for us. But those birds were secure, and it was great. And then they did it 2 more times this summer. So, well,
you know, you're always trying to chase that high of your first viral video.
So, yeah.
The birds just wanted to get more TikTok famous.
Yep. They didn't, though. So that was good. In fact, it's so funny because that first fly-off had media coverage, and, you know, the zoo was getting calls, and it was TikTok, and there was news vans and stuff, and they did it 2 more times and nobody cared.
That's so funny.
It became normalized. It was like, oh, it's those birds again. Okay. You good? Yeah. Okay. We're good too. Great. Nice.
Yeah. I do remember, like, so we were chilling here, and, Danny was up on, the lift. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I don't know this stuff, but yeah, she was up on the lift with the perch and like, so trying to keep eyes out, but you and I were just on the ground. Mm-hmm. And we just like, we were just chatting, and I remember kind of being like, you cool? And you were like, yeah. And we were just talking about life, and I was like, oh, this is clearly not a big deal, because like, I imagined it would be terrifying, but I drum again. So yeah. If my drum suddenly disappeared, I'd be really concerned.
I mean, there's a level of concern. Like, I mean, I think I went, well, there they go. And there they went. Yeah. So here's the thing. I think we fully accept that we are only half of the information that any of these animals have. The animal has the other half of the information. And if we acknowledge that those animals are their own creatures, then they can choose to do things that perhaps we would not like them to do. And sometimes you watch that happen in real time and you're like, oh, that's a decision that they're making as they fly outside the zoo property. And also, I know what that is going to mean for my next 24 hours. And, you know, after you've experienced that a number of times, I think it's less about panic and more about how can we make sure that we are in the right place at the right time for these animals to come home safely.
Makes sense. And I guess that gets more into the overall training. So I'm going to turn it over to an expert and y'all can chat.
Oh my God, an expert?
An expert.
I need to be humbled, Amy. Well, no, like we were just talking about that fly off and it was really funny because I was up in that lift and you guys were totally joking. But at one point, John, you looked at me and were like, Danny, we're blaming this on you. And so I like in my trainer brain, I was like, I knew you were kidding. But I was also like, did I do something? What happened here? And like you guys were down there talking, but Nathan and I were up in the lift and the information that I was given was just keep your ear, like listen and let's see if we, or let's try to hear for them. And at one point we did hear macaws and we both looked at each other and we're like, oh my God, did you hear that? And so then our eyes were like out. And then we realized
it was the hyacinths. Oh my God.
It was just like Roger William Park Zoo's resident hyacinths that were on exhibit. And we were like, ah, dang it. And then we started talking about like, ooh, what is that antecedent like? Like we have these, you know, other macaws that are out on display. So my first question for you is, did you ever have an incident with the hyacinths?
I need you to look for some wood to knock on because
we've got one more week left.
Yeah, we have one more week of shows. And I have said multiple times to multiple people, I cannot believe our birds have not found those hyacinths yet because they are sitting like within 120 feet of our show area. They have a big old bowl of food. Yes. They're hanging out there. And historically, we have had macaws, free-flying macaws, find static display macaws and exert their influence over those birds. Mm-hmm. And I had said to the lead keeper over there, I was like, just so you know, if our birds find your birds, it's going to be a thing that we are going to have to deal with as a group. And again, I still am looking for wood to knock on.
Right behind you.
Here we go. There we go. Knocked. It's somehow not happened. Mm-hmm. And I hope it does not, but it is, it's possible.
Right.
I mean,
I hope it doesn't happen.
Me too.
It's crazy. Even to see the training with the macaws and how it's evolved from the last time we were here.
Oh, yeah.
Like it's really cool because we got to see that training in action and then we were there for that fly off. It wasn't a catastrophic fly off, but it was wild to like see it happen and for you guys to be so casual about it. And I hadn't even contacted you guys. I had no idea what had come of that. I got sent a TikTok video from someone who thought it was funny. Danny, did you see this on TikTok? And I was like, I'm really glad it's you in the video that's creating them. And I'm like, oh, well, I'm really glad she got them back. I didn't see that they got them back, but I was actually there for the fly off.
And I think the thing for us, like, and I've heard this a lot, especially from other facilities or other people who have visited us and have watched us react to a fly off or behavior that we weren't expecting. And everybody says, you're so casual, you're so calm. And yes, but there's a reason behind it. Like we're not flippant. Like it's not because we don't care. It's because panicking, first of all, doesn't help anybody do anything.
Right.
And second of all, I think we have the training and the knowledge to be able to effectively act on the information we're getting from those animals. Mm-hmm. So it's, I've told this story a few times, but, and I wish this is an audible media, so I can't show you what it looks like. But if you see a group of mixed trainers, NEI trainers and guests out in the field and birds are doing a thing, you will see the moment when suddenly every single NEI trainer there stops and looks and then starts walking in a separate direction. And the guests will be like, wait, what? What's happening? And every NEI trainer, based on the thing that that animal did at the time, that was the difference between a normal behavior and something that could be a precursor to something we don't want to see. Suddenly, every trainer there responds to it, and it's calm, mm-hmm. but they respond to it. Mm-hmm. They look at the behavior and they react to it, because that's all we can go on, is the behavior of the animal that we're interacting with.
Right, right. Well, speaking of free-flying birds, mm-hmm. as somebody who is in the field but doesn't necessarily free-fly birds in the way that you guys do, and as somebody who's trying to build up the confidence to do that with a certain pied crow that yes. I train, that we have the luxury of having netting surrounding mm-hmm. our entire show area. So they're basically in a secondary space. And so that's a nice way to start building the foundation for that type of free flight that you guys do, I think. But John makes fun of me because I was talking to him about how much I really want to build up, you know, that courage to truly free fly this bird. And he's like, you know, you won't free fly Russell, but you'll let your beagle out of your house to go pee and poop in the backyard. And you're so confident that he's going to come in when I live on a highway. So if he makes the choice to go into the front yard instead of the backyard, like, it was such a valid point, John, mm-hmm. because I'm like, you're so right. Like, I have the confidence that I've trained my dog well enough that he's going to go outside, go to the bathroom, come right in for his cookie, but I won't let Russell out of the show arena. So anyway, what are the tools that you think a bird has to have in their toolbox? Because I feel like I would know how you would respond is, what are the tools that the trainer has to have in their toolbox mm-hmm. to have the confidence to free fly? But what do you feel like are the most solid behaviors that that animal has to have to do a successful free flight?
We also have a paper on this. I think that there are very, very specific prerequisite behaviors that an animal, a free flying animal, needs before you accept that they are free flying at that level. Mm-hmm. And it's recall. It's mm-hmm. And recall, by recall, I mean not just coming back to the hand, but they have to have a backup recall. So if it's a raptor, do they come to the lure? Do they come to the glove? Do they come to the crate? If it's a parrot, do they self-load? Do they come to the hand? What do they come back to? Have their main recall and then have a secondary recall. Okay. So, for example, those militaries who flew off, they will come down to the hand to people that they know, but they will also come down to, the nice word for it is, a bug out perch. So a specific, it's just a little step ladder with a perch on top of it. And if they see that, that is a safe space. They will come down to that anytime they see it. Yep. So if you are in a situation where you can't call them down to the hand, they'll come to the perch. Mm-hmm. For our pied crow, if she can't come down to my hand, she'll come down to the crate. Mm-hmm. She knows the crate. So you always have a backup option for recall. And then are they competent? So when I say that, if you are going to fly an animal, a bird, in an area, are they physically competent to fly in all of the conditions that would be possible in that area? Can they navigate wind? Can they land? Because a lot of them can't, especially mm-hmm. if they didn't learn to fly as young birds, if they didn't learn to fly and fledge properly. Coming down from a height is a prereq behavior that many of these animals do not have. Mm-hmm. So we test that. I need to know an animal will come down from a height at a steep angle in wind mm-hmm. before I can trust that they'll do it outside of a netted area.
And would you evaluate that competence in a secondary
yes,
location?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Either in a secondary or with a, like with a transmitter or with something that is a safety net. Mm-hmm. I mean, we care about these animals. Right. We want to make sure, you know, you don't want Russell to do anything that you haven't seen that he is capable of doing before you make him do it in an area that you can't control.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, but on the other side of that, the trainer has to trust what they see in right. the animal. So sometimes the trainer is too afraid to go to the next spot with their bird because suddenly they're the one that is responsible for that fly off. And the first time you are fully responsible for that animal and they are no longer in quote unquote your control, that's a lot. Mm-hmm. That's a lot.
Yeah.
Yep. There were some tears early on in my career. There were a lot of tears. Mm-hmm. But eventually you learn to trust them and you learn to trust what you see. And then it gets a lot more comfortable where you can say, yes, this animal is capable of doing this. I trust them. I don't care if in our case, our pied crow, White Claw can go 50 feet up in a tree. I don't care. Mm-hmm. She'll come down when she feels like it / when the conditions are right, competently, because I know that that bird can dive from like 200 feet in the air if she wants to. Mm-hmm. She is excellent at flying because we made sure she had those skills.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's awesome. Taking notes over here. So we saw a lot of kind of behind the scenes that you did today. And we saw a lot of the like catch and release. You were T3, mm-hmm. I believe, today. So you were doing all that stuff. And it was really cool to see you kind of like baiting their crates, listening for certain cues from the trainers that were out there on mic, listening to your communication on the radio with the other trainers and watching some of those animals come back. We had a lot of fun just being able to watch that whole process. And you and I talked a little bit about the matching law because I had asked you, what are you using as like, is the stuff that you're baiting inside the crate the highest value reinforcer? Is that the most important part? And your response was really interesting to me. So I think it would be cool for other people to hear what you said back to me and like how it is dependent on the bird and what their behavior's like. So if you want to talk about that a little bit.
Sure. I mean, the traditional NEI answer is # it depends, mm-hmm. because it depends entirely on what we're seeing from the animal. So in our case, what they receive as a reinforcer for returning from their show behavior is going to depend on the behavior that they showed out when they were on the public side. So if they are showing us that the value of the reinforcers out on public side aren't high enough, and what we would see with that is exiting early, mm-hmm. that they're like, all right, well, I came out here and time to go home. And we're like, we didn't want you to go home yet. What you doing? And that's usually because the value of the reinforcer behind the scenes in the what we call the catch is out competing the reinforcers that are available on the public side, or maybe the behavior on public side is more difficult. So then mm-hmm. we have to out compete the difficulty with additional reinforcers. So it's always a balancing act. You know, for us, going home is the most important behavior.
Right.
I would rather have the problem of an animal exiting early because they know that their crate is a safe space and they're going to go there. That's a great problem to have.
Right.
I would much rather solve that problem by outcompeting the go home behavior with cool stuff outside than try to solve the problem of a bird who does not want to come home. So we do the best we possibly can to make sure that the go home behavior is the strongest, but sometimes, as we talked about, we have to shift the value of the reinforcers to other behaviors.
Right. Yeah. And it was so interesting for me to see and to watch the birds get information from so many different people, essentially, but also for them to be well-conditioned enough to know where to look for the information within their routine. So I think that was just like such strong training. And I think that was like what I was most impressed by, being able to see everything behind the scenes. I have one more question, and it's, I wanted to test myself. I asked these guys, I was like, do you guys think that you know what the cue was to get the macaws to fly home? And I think I know what it was, but I'm not sure. And I kind of want to say it and then have you tell me whether or not I'm right. And I could be wrong, so this might be embarrassing. But is it when T1 lifts up the blue-throated macaw? Should we ask John?
Yes, ask everybody.
Okay, John, what did you think it was?
I was not entirely sure, but that was actually my guess. Like when you asked the question, that was my thought. But from watching what we saw, and I want to talk about this in a minute, my guess is that it wasn't a cue from the T1, but was something that the T2 was doing. And we will explain, listeners, what these different T's are here in a minute. But my thought was that while it's like a magician, while we're all looking in one place, the birds are actually trained to look somewhere else and are looking at, another person, here in this case, I think it was what Sean was. Yeah, that's my guess. Zoe, do you have an opinion?
I also don't know and wasn't paying that much attention, but to me, it looked like the majority of the macaws were getting pretty constant reinforcement from the trainers they were working with. They stopped and then they went away.
Did I get it?
Dang, girl.
Good job,
Zoe. Nice.
Yeah. So good job, Zoe. A lot of the time, I think trainers try to make things too hard on themselves. In our case, in the absence of reinforcers, the birds go home.
That's sick. That's so smart and so simple. Yeah.
So in our case, and if you wanted to put a cue on it, the cue is T2 and T4 stepping away from the macaws. So they're giving a fairly decent rate of reinforcement. These birds just flew a quarter mile to get here. They get lots of treats for doing so. And when those treats stop being available and the trainers step away, that is the cue for those birds to go home.
Cool. Really glad I put myself on the spot for that. Now I'm in a safe space.
Good job, Zoe.
I'm in a safe space. I knew I wasn't going to be punished for possibly being wrong. I did notice when I was at the IAATE conference in 2018, I got to see the winged encounters at the Tree of Life. And obviously they do the free flying with the macaws. And when they did step off the ladders was when they flew away. So I understood that one well enough. Just was like, wow, this one is definitely the blue throat. So it's very wrong, but it's okay.
No,
it is okay. But it's also a really interesting point that something that I talk about on Zoo News a lot, because this stuff just keeps happening, is just a friendly reminder from that just because you think you're seeing something, especially in the animal world, doesn't mean that what you're seeing makes sense. It's almost like the person who always says, the sea turtle needs a friend because it's lonely. And that's just not how that works on a much more advanced level. But there were three of us all paying attention, all who saw different things that we thought were cues, and only one of us was right. Jerk. I do think it's a good reminder that, like, just because you think you're seeing something doesn't necessarily mean that you do, even if you are an expert, you know?
To be fair, cool. She also prefaced it by saying she wasn't paying attention.
No, that's true. I mean, and I do think that is true. But I just, this is something that I'm always so fascinated about in the world in general, because I will be outside at a zoo and I will hear people watching zookeepers or watching a training session or something like that and talking about it. And honestly, sometimes I'm blown away by what they think they're seeing. And like, yeah, I know more about this world now, but again, drummer, not really a super expert in this, you know, and yet it's fascinating to see what people think. So I always like to kind of point that out.
We heard a man walk up to the show the other day and in all like earnest behavior turn to the person he was with and say, "Did you know that all birds eat their own body weight every single day?" And I was like, I looked at my birds and I was like, that's going to be pretty rough for us. I'm like, how's that going for the ostrich? Who's eating 400 pounds of food every day? That's a lot. So yeah, I get it. And you know, people know what they know and sometimes they think they know what they know and they don't know, but
so we talked a little bit about the team and the T's and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So the last thing that I want to talk about before we get to our final couple questions is just, can you talk about the teamwork? And like, I think that most people, if they saw the show, especially if they see the main show, not the one that is apparently meant for little kids, which is actually my favorite show.
It's so
now
cute.
I have some questions about myself, but anyway, so, you know, talk about what goes into it. Cause I think most people will see like, there's a person on the stage and then there's, you might notice the person in the back or like sometimes you fly between people or whatever, but there's a whole team. And can you talk not just about the different positions, but how communication works, because that was awesome.
Oh, cool. I'm glad you like that, because I think we're pretty proud of it. I think that, you know, I've said more often lately personally that training is a team sport. So what we do is there are positions. The T1, T2, T3, T4, T5. In some shows, that goes up to T7.
Wow.
What
does T stand for?
Trainer.
Oh, that makes
sense.
So
it's okay. Trainer one, trainer two, trainer three. It's not that exciting, but you know, we call them. So for us, traditionally, T1 is the lead speaker. In some shows, T2 is either the secondary speaker or the lead house person. T3 is often the lead backstage person, the catch release person. It really depends on the show. But the point is that each trainer position has duties. They have expected jobs. They feed this bird here. They catch this bird here. They say this thing on the radio. They do this thing here. And that level of antecedent arrangement when it comes to duties helps us communicate effectively as a team, because we need to know that T1 is responsible for these things and T2 is responsible for these things, because sometimes something goes wrong in the show. And one of the things I'm most proud of, because, and again, going back to it, is we only have half of the information. So these animals are their own animals. And we had a show a while ago where our grand hornbill, who is the opening bird for the show, instead of coming back to stage, just kept getting higher and flew outside of the zoo. And it was, first of all, I've never seen her. I'm staring at her right now.
Skeeter, what did you do?
We're all looking at her right now. Shaming, shame. I've never seen her fly that high, and it was not great. But the point was that in that moment, because we are all in radio communication, no, I was T3 for that show. So I was the backstage person, the only backstage person who is catching and releasing birds. And on the radio, I said, I am going to find Skeeter, T2, come back and do T3. So in that moment, live in the show, we shifted what we were doing. I left show to go find that bird. And the show continued, and the audience never knew anything happened. They saw a bird do a really cool flight and were probably like, oh, that's strange that that bird went that high and that fast. And all of us were probably peeing our pants a little bit, but you know, that show continued and I still had a radio in my ear as I climbed over the side of a highway and down onto railroad tracks. I could still hear that they were going through with the birds and they were doing a phenomenal job and all the other birds, and they chose to bag. So we chose not to fly some of the higher risk birds that would have needed the full team there.
Right.
So people made great decisions. No problem if one bird doesn't come out. The audience doesn't know what the full show looks like. So it's not a big deal if the crane doesn't come out that time. So we were able to get that grand hornbill secure, you know, an hour later, which the stage show had continued and finished at a really high level. And the audience had no idea, and everything worked well. And that was because of team communication.
That's really cool. I love that. Yeah. And I think it's really interesting too, to see, like, when we were backstage, you know, watching as you T3'd, it's not just like opening a door. Like, you have to listen for the cue line, mm-hmm. and you move the birds around so that each bird, when it is their time to come out, they are like properly positioned to launch accordingly, basically. And, you know, you hear the Q word and you open the thing and they're supposed to fly off, but sometimes they make choices. Sometimes there happen to be three seeds laying around on a table that are very interesting seeds and they must be consumed first. And it's just interesting. Like the next time that you're at a zoo, if you're listening to this and you happen to go to a bird show, especially if it's a good one, just try to think about all the logistics that need to go into having birds magically appear and fly around for like 3 minutes or 5 minutes and then leave. It's really amazing. Like, it was really cool to see.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to say even about that is what I think is so cool is somebody who like does talk in shows. You guys have walkie-talkies attached to you that are connected to earpieces that you keep in your ear. So T1 doesn't turn those walkies off because mm-hmm. they need to get all the information about what's going on outside of their line of vision. So while T1 is talking, they've got information coming into their ear. So I thought this was wild and crazy. So I was like, I want to try this in my shows at the zoo. So me and one of my staff members did just for the heck of it. We had some like cheap ones and we tried it, and it, you know, it's so ridiculous how challenging it is to make sure you're paying attention to the bird, make sure you're paying attention to what you're saying, and make sure you're listening to the information, because sometimes whatever information you're getting in your ear forces you to change your behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Did that take a long time for you to adjust? How is that for new people who are talking into mic for the first time?
I think that's the biggest challenge, honestly, is that the T1, the lead speaker, has to be competent being able to speak to the public and make a connection with those people. So it's not just a script. Like, they have to genuinely interact with those people while actively paying attention to their animal and training that animal, sometimes actively in the show. Like, they're not little robots. They don't come out and do their thing and go. The T1 is an active trainer, and their reinforcers will change tomorrow's behavior or the afternoon show's behavior if they're not careful, for better or worse. And then also you have a voice or sometimes multiple voices in your ear at the same time. It is a challenge. And I will not say that there are not times where, especially if T2 and T3 are having a conversation, where T1 just doesn't pop their earpiece out or turn the mic down. Because it gets to be a bit much. But very rarely does it happen. Yes, it is something that has to be learned. It is difficult to be able to do all of those things at the same time, but it is worth doing because the information that you get is valuable when you're the T1. Mm-hmm. Like, it's worth having that voice in your ear saying, well, one of the best examples we have, you didn't see it today because it hasn't been sunny, but our little trumpeter hornbill, in the morning, the sun hits her crate. So when you open the door, she'll pop out of her crate and just immediately melt. Like, just, yay, it's a beautiful sunny day. And so she'll start sunning, her wings come out, she turns into a puddle. And I have to be like, you got to stall because she's not coming out yet. It's going to be a minute. So T1 needs that information so that they can smoothly keep the audience interested, knowing that there's going to be a delay in that bird coming out because the bird is having a sunbath, which is awesome.
Just
so you know, the bird that you just sent home is not secure. He flew over my head and is on a roof.
That would never happen.
How could that have happened? It definitely didn't happen twice today.
And we actually had a radio on us for the second show today, so we were able to listen to some of the stuff because, I mean, before you had your headpiece in for the first show, so we saw you adapting to different things they were saying, but we couldn't hear what was being said. But in the second show, we got to hear some of what was being said, and it was its own show.
Yes.
It was so much fun to hear what you guys were saying behind the scenes.
My favorite comment was when Amy was like, oh, by the way, if anybody has a radio out in the public, please make sure it's turned down. I was like, yeah, I already turned you down. I did. I promise. I would not screw you over like that.
Listen, backstage stays backstage.
Yeah, so. No, that's real. Actually, you know, it's kind of funny, but this isn't even a question. It's just a comment. I don't know what to do with this, but my listeners know that over the last couple of years, as I've gotten more and more into this world and more passionate about it, I've started to try to figure out more what my role is here, like maybe beyond the podcast, you know? And the thing that I walked away from the last time with, but especially today with, is how well trained I am for all of this, except for the training part of it. Because I've obviously never done training. I mean, a little bit with the dog, you know, whatever. I listened to lots of the NEI Tech Talks and the ABMA podcast that's out now. So I like to think that I'm a competent trainer, but that's just listening to podcasts. It's slightly different. Outside of that, like even like as you're talking about having different sources coming into your ears and still performing and stuff, you know, I can't tell you how many times as the music director of Million Dollar Quartet, I'm on stage delivering lines, playing the drums, tracking what all of my musicians are doing. And if there's an emergency, I have a stage manager whispering in my ear or tapping me while I'm playing a drum solo or something. All of a sudden you get tap, 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 and adapting to all of that and knowing how to, with my own shows and stuff, talk to audiences and improvise. And like you said, stall because a guitar string broke or whatever. Mm-hmm. Well, different than a bird flying off, but also not. And I don't know what to do with this yet, but like, it has really hit me hard today how many of the conversations we've all had and the stuff that y'all are talking about and sharing stories of like these one-off things that have happened to you that I can equate one-on-one to something that's happened on stage with me. And I'm like, I don't know what to do with that, but that's cool to know, I guess. I don't know. It's been interesting.
It's performance. Yeah. Like at the end of the day, the reason that we have these animals and we're doing this performance is because we truly believe that it is the way to connect humans to the natural world. So getting birds out there over people's heads or giving a kid a chance to have an owl fly directly over their heads is worth it, but it is a show. And that's fine. And it comes with all of the things that doing a show well comes with, which is team communication, sometimes quick decision making, and practice and repetition over and over to make sure that the thing that you're producing is worth producing, that it's a product, I guess, if you want to say it that coldly, that is something that's worth putting out there. Mm-hmm. And our goal is to make dang sure that it is worth doing every time we do it. And it's interesting to me to hear you say that. And I was like, oh yeah, I know what that feels like. Like that's a thing that we have experienced. And at the end of the day, it's all, how do you talk to people?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
How do you do that efficiently? Yeah. And that's what we do. We try anyway to do it as efficiently as possible, whether you're drumming or whether you are throwing birds at people. Yeah. Or whatever.
No, I mean, and actually, like Danny was saying, like, and it was funny because we talk a lot, but we've never discussed this particular thing. But she was saying, like, she noticed that your show ending is a bigger ending than what she does right now. And she's thinking, how can we adjust, you know? And I was like, had we ever discussed that, I 100% would have told you. As soon as I said, you always close with the hit. Like 100% of the time, you always close with the hit.
Start and, big and bigger.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you guys do dollar bill donations, which we do as well, but you do that demonstration right before your grand finale. Mm-hmm. And I think that's so smart because you're getting that big grand finale, that round of applause, you're flying the crane. I mean, like, it was such a great reaction from the audience today. And then it was, yeah, okay, now you guys can come on up and let's contribute to conservation. And I was like, heck yeah. And you ended your show on the crane, but then it was like an after show situation with the donation. Mm-hmm. Which for us right now, we're ending the show after we invite the audience to come up to do donations. And I'm not getting that big round of applause and it feels uncomfortable. So I was like, dang, like, yeah, I just need to switch it up. I need my recycling behavior at the very end because that could be our grand finale.
Yeah, we talk about making sure that we earn that from the audience. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Steve is amazing with stuff like this. So like part of it is the start big and bigger. So the first thing we do should engage the audience at a high level. And then the last thing we do had better engage the audience at a very high level. But also I think we try to earn our reinforcers from the audience. So we try to earn applause. We never ask for it, at least for people. We'll ask for it for volunteers, like for the audience, we'll ask for it, but we'll never ask for it for ourselves or our birds because we got to earn it. And then additionally for the donations specifically, I think we had a really big conversation about this on this team mid-season about earning the right to ask people to contribute. And to do that, we have to engage them at a level that makes them feel like they get a chance to participate instead of that we're hustling. So that's our goal. Like I want kids to run up with a dollar bill to shove it in that crow's beak because they want to engage with that animal, not because we're guilting it out of them or because we're dragging it out of them. Like we want to do it because we earned it.
Not to mention your donation bin is gorgeous. And I've talked about that.
Rob Buells, who is incredible. We have two of them and the other one's in Minnesota right now. He made those and they are absolutely gorgeous.
They are gorgeous.
Yes.
Yeah. But I just, I, they are gorgeous. But also I, like I said, though, it is amazing to me that like, you know, had we talked about it from a performance standpoint, and I'm even wondering if that's something I could help with down the liners. I don't know. We should probably talk about this more off the podcast because I feel like there's a world where my expertise could help out a lot of these types of shows, especially like NEI is amazing. I have been to bird shows that are not that. I won't name any names. And no, it's not Southwicks. Don't give me that look, Dan. Wow. You guys are amazing. You know, no, but I do think there's really something to that. But anyway, for the people listening who don't just want to hear about my future potential career aspirations, are there any conservation organizations you'd like to give a shout out to?
World Paratrust. I mean, incredible work done by incredible people. There are a lot of, I mean, we're very lucky at NEI because we have NECF, which is our conservation fund, and we, all of the money we raise in shows. What we were just talking about, you know, kids running up and giving a dollar to a raven or a crow that goes into a box that is very pretty. Thank you, Rob. That goes directly to in situ conservation. It does not, there's no overhead. We don't keep any of it. It all directly goes to conservation. And for NECF, there's a bunch of projects, Volpro, the Hornbill Project, Mumbala, all sorts of things. We support turtles and giraffes and all sorts of Javan rhinos and the Peregrine Fund and all sorts of crazy things. But for me, World Paratrust is, and Volpro, but World Paratrust.
Awesome. And then since you've now said four different times that, you know, there are kids things that I'm like, oh, that's my favorite thing. I've been insulted enough. So we're going to wrap it up, but it is time. It's time now, don't you know? We've come to the end of the show. But there's one tale left to go. You're going to laugh and say, oh no. It's time for the Rossifari poop story.
Great. So there's actually a photo of this. and it was very early on, right after we opened Winged Encounters at a place that I think I'm allowed to talk about, but I'm not sure, so I'm not going to say it.
contracts are fun.
Contracts. We talked about it earlier, and I was a brand new NEI employee, and I was under the perch, and somebody, we both wear glasses, so somebody pooped down my face in between my glasses and like just absolutely crapped all over my face. And my response was to take my glasses, whip them into the bush, wipe my face off and keep going. And then we sent the birds, we sent them, like, that flock is much bigger than what we fly here. And they all flew away, and I'm blind as a bat without my glasses. I have no idea. So I'm like, wiping poop off my face, and also I'm like, does anybody know where my glasses are? Like, does anybody at any point know where my glasses are? Somebody fished them out of the bushes and gave them back to me. But what I didn't know was somebody took a photo of the moment that the bird crapped all over my face, like down my eye. And that photo is available for a fee. So
incredible. Thank you so much for taking the time for doing this.
This is great.
We appreciate it. This has been such a wonderful day.
Thank you for coming. It's awesome to have you guys here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big NEI and Amy fan. So thanks for letting me tag along, John.
Yay.
Woo, yay.
Man, I just love the NEI team so much. I had such a great time with Amy and all of the people there. And it just makes me want to get back down to Florida and talk to more people from this team. And it inspires me so much to keep learning more about training. And as you guys heard, just kind of figuring out what my place in this world can be, because it is awesome to see the impact that people like Amy and the team at Roger Williams Park Zoo and Steve Martin and everyone at NEI have on the animals of the world. It's just so cool. I love them all so much. So before I get going, I want to take a moment to say thank you to my Red Panda level patrons, Dr. Laura Shank, Dr. Stephen Williamson, and Barbara Bennett, and to remind you all that you can become a patron of Raw Safari for as little as $3 a month by going to patreon.com/rawsafari. There are some fun perks there, and it helps support the podcast, which is lovely. And other than that, all I really have to say is that I want y'all to remember that the word credits backwards is Stiderk.
The Raw Safari podcast is produced, hosted, and engineered by John Rossi. Editing and fact-checking by John and Dr. Zoe Rossi. Our theme song is Sevens by Nathan Burke, performed by Nathan and John. Interrupting John theme and additional voices by Taylor Isaac Gray. You can reach John directly on Instagram and Facebook at Raw Safari or by email at rawsafaripod@gmail.com. Raw Safari is part of the Daydreamer Media Network. Now, stop listening to me and go visit a zoo.